All right. Thanks for being here. It's that time to begin. This is session 323. Is the Mormon Church still racist? Methodological approaches to the problem of race in Mormonism. Our presenter is Roy Whitaker. He's a graduate student at Claremont Graduate University. He's in the Philosophy of Religion and Theology doctoral program. His research areas include pragmatism, cultural theory, and comparative religion. He has two master's degrees, one from Harvard and one from Princeton. I'm guessing those are some kind of schools. I've never heard of those.
It's
a community college in Salt Lake. I see, yes. Very impressive. Makes me feel dumb just reading it. All right. He's traveled, studied, and worked in Jamaica, India, and Germany. We're very fortunate to have Margaret Blair Young responding to Roy. She's an instructor in creative writing at BYU, an award-winning playwright of I Am Jane and Deerstone, among others. She's a novelist of Heresies of Nature, which was a really great book. Co-author of the Standing on the Promises series with Darius, and a trilogy of books about the experience of Black Mormon pioneer Black Mormons from pioneer days to the present. Mother of four children, and recently as well, the author of just a beautiful blog post online about her grandmother and her passing. Just a couple of quick Sunstone housekeeping reminders that we say, of course, at every session. Make sure your cell phones are turned off, your pagers are turned off if you traveled back in time and got a pager. Book sales are in the room next to us, in the Harvest Room, I believe. That supports Sunstone and Benchmark Books. We'd encourage you to get books there. We're going to have a couple of really good author meets critic sessions this afternoon on the Mountain Meadows book and some other things, and we encourage you to pick those up there. For the Q&A session, as always, make sure you speak into the mic. These sessions are recorded and sold by Sunstone, and the listening audience who buys those is much larger than the number of people that can attend the symposium, and it's a big source of revenue for Sunstone. So make sure all your comments get into the microphone, please. And if you do have a comment, we encourage that. Please just do your best to keep it about a minute or so, so that we can allow others to speak as well. We love Sunstone, but it's not open mic night at the coffee shop, so try and keep that in mind. With that, let's get to Roy's paper.
Good morning.
Morning.
Good to see you guys here today, and I'd like to thank my panel, and thank you very much for the introduction. I'd like to begin also by thanking Professor Brian Birch for inviting me here and his support in my work. The title of my paper is the Mormon Church Still Racist? Methodological Approaches to the Problem of Race in Mormonism. I had the privilege last March of attending my very first Sunstone symposium in Claremont, California. And at one of the sessions, I heard somebody ask the question, is the Mormon Church still racist? Now, I found the question to be, number one, extremely loaded. And I also found the question to be done in a very strong candor kind of a way. The question assumes that the church was necessarily racist at one time, and that it now still might be. One answer at the time was instructive. The fact that the Genesis group exists demonstrates that the church is still dealing with issues of racism are raised today. This question, which is the title of this paper and this symposium, is the subtext of all discourse on racism and Mormonism today. This question is controversial. According to Almond Moss, who I think I saw him in a bookstore not too far away from here, has said that to most white Mormons, the race problem has been solved in 1978 simply by the change in priesthood policy. However, just because there was a change in policy or practice doesn't mean there was a change in attitude and belief. This ban was specifically geared toward people of African descent. And the rescinding of it occurred 126 years after 178 years of the church's existence. This ban was rescinded 10 long years after Martin Luther King Jr.'s assassination. And this ban was rescinded despite the fact that there is a strong evangelical push for converts in Africa. And that is the case. There has been little to no institutional change in the church regarding, for example, diversifying church leadership. How many black, brown, yellow, red Mormon apostles in quorum of 70 are there? Bringhurst and Smith and Black and Mormonism, Black and Mormon are right. The church must do something about its image as a racist organization. What I'd like to do is not simply just answer the question, is the Mormon church still racist? But what I'd like to do is actually look at how this question has been approached. Basically, what method works best at getting at such a provocative question? In short, over the past 30 years, the various methods and approaches to getting at this problem have been insufficient. There have been four traditional ones. But Eugene England, in his dialogue with Dwight Hopkins in Mormonism and Dialogue, represents another more apt approach, in my view, a contextual approach. So, the four traditional ways of approaching the controversy on whether the Mormon church is still racist. The first one, and I know many of you here have heard of this one or at least experienced it, the guilt by association method. That's the sins of the father approach. What this approach does is it says that the Mormon church today is struggling with race issues, and because it struggled with racism in the past, it must necessarily struggle with it today. Basically, what this approach does is it tends to use past quotes by former prophets as proof that the church is racist today. An example of this is by quoting Bruce McConkie, a former apostle and strong exponent of the ban. McConkie says this: Negroes in this life are denied the priesthood. Under no circumstance can they hope that this delegation of authority from the Almighty. The gospel message of salvation is not carried affirmatively to them. In 1958, McConkie rationalizes the ban. The present status of the Negro rests purely and simply on the foundation of pre-existence. Along with all races and peoples, he is receiving here what he merits as a result of a long premortal probation in the presence of the Lord. Now, what individuals do in this situation is they'll use these words as leverage over the new generation of LDS saints, as though this necessarily applies to them. Now, on the one hand, this move does make sense, because the role of the prophet is very, very high in the LDS church. So the words of the prophets do matter. However, in Mormon culture, there is a strong line by line, and precept upon precept thought, where not everything is perfectly revealed at all times to church leaders. So that must be respected as well. The second approach that people have used to get at the answer to this question, the double standard method, throwing rocks in glass houses approach. What this approach does is says that the Mormon Church today is grappling with race issues, but it ignores the fact that other traditions are struggling with race issues too, in particularly even their own traditions. If we look at the work of Robert Millet, for example, he hints at this problem in his spirited essay, What Do We Really Believe? In Discourses in Mormonism, Mormon Theology, 2007. Millet says, we are challenged in our literature on such matters as why blacks were denied the priesthood prior to 1978. Those of other faiths who leap to criticize the church and question its truthfulness because of past teachings would do well to ask themselves if they are prepared to apply the same standards of judgment to their own tradition. What Millet is saying here is fair. Can other faith traditions, can other Christian communities live up to the idea that no racism ever existed in their communities, then or today? For example, in India, in Hindu life, they're still struggling with the sting of the color-coded caste system. For example, 60% of all Indian Christians, 60% come from the untouchable caste. Out of the 60% of all Indian Christians, how many are bishops? 10%. According to the BBC World Service 2001, apartheid may have been abolished, but separate worship along racial lines remains the norm in South Africa. The point I'm trying to make early on in my discussion with you is that the problem of racism in Mormonism is not solely a Mormon problem. And if a person seeks to heap coals on Mormonism, then in some respects, they're throwing rocks in glass houses. Third approach, the silent approach, the out of sight, out of mind approach. This approach to this particular problem, is the Mormon Church still racist or not, seeks to be as quiet as a mouse on the topic. In effect, saying that the problem is really no problem at all. This framework is emblematic of church leadership throughout history. For example, in 1998, Gordon Hinckley responded to the revelation. Quote, the 1978 revelation comes to speak for itself. I don't see anything further we need to do. According to Richard and Joan Osling in Mormon America, they say this. The church educational system's current seminary high school level text on church history tosses 10 words about the revelation into a laundry list on the Kimball administration. So just 10 words only, never mentioning race and the longstanding ban. Another source says this. Many Mormons are in denial about the ban, unwilling to talk in church settings about it. A silent approach. And then there is the romanticized method, the rose-colored glasses approach. What this approach does is this. It says and seeks to over-historicize and over-theologize the problem, basically to the point that nobody is responsible for it. The ban is simply the product of 19th and 20th century America, on the one hand. And then, as we know, on the other, God had allowed it. So therefore, nobody is responsible for it. Mormon insiders and apologists usually fall into this camp. President Kimball, on June 8, 1978, issued a historic letter All worthy male members of the church may be ordained to the priesthood without regard for race or color. Now, Klaus Hansen in Mormonism and the American Experience says that this change, however momentous, might well have been affected by a mere policy directive. Instead, the letter emphatically made it known that the church had come by way of revelation, this policy change. Margaret Toscano is right. The 1978 revelation on the priesthood and blacks is not God changing his mind, but the prohibitive policy was the result of human prejudice. The final section, the fifth, and what I hope to be a helpful approach to this particular problem, the contextual method. What the contextual method seeks to do is avoid the problems of guilt by association, double standards, remaining silent and romanticizing the issue. What it does is say that the parts are related to the whole. What that basically means is that culture influences theology. Okay. And then ultimately, theology also influences culture. This approach does basically, or emphasizes, four different things. Attentiveness, intentional rootedness, inclusivity, and transformation. Attentiveness to the cries of the marginalized. Internal rootedness, appreciating historical currents. Inclusivity, bringing in voices that have been pushed to the side. And transformation, which is basically changing the church and changing society. It's this method that is exemplified by Eugene England in his work. England is a highly respected Mormon thinker and has unfortunately passed away a number of years ago. He came to the conclusion that racism still persisted in the church even after the ban was removed. Work still needs to be done, he says, though behavior has changed dramatically. The false ideas that were invented to rationalize racist practices are still with us. He provides evidence of this. Mormons have not yet officially or unofficially clearly repudiated racist theology. Some Mormons still believe that blacks as well as other colored people come color-coded in the world. And then there are some books, one called Tolerance by Elder John Carmack, reprinted in 1997, that actually continues the thought that blacks come from a certain Cain lineage, the Mark, and even the Ham doctrine of servitude as well. England is attentive to the cries of the marginalized. He recognizes that without people like Martin Luther King Jr. and Malcolm X and other black religious leaders, the ban would have never been removed. He says specifically that President Kimball told the press after the 1978 revelation that the revelation came at this time because conditions and people have changed. It's a different world than it was 20, 25 years ago. The world is ready for it now. So part of the irony of the dialogue of the priesthood ban is how those who were excluded from it and those outside the community actually contribute to the overthrow of it. England is intentionally rooted. He understands that all things are rooted in historical currents. Quote, "When I was growing up in the 1940s and 1950s in Utah, I was a racist in what appeared to be a thoroughly racist society." The point England is making is that no predominantly white institution, particularly a religious one, is free of racism to the degree that it's reflective of a larger social makeup. England is inclusive. He enters into dialogue with Dwight Hopkins, a very well-respected black theologian. And interestingly, they both come to a similar conclusion, that the issue of racism in the church can't be divorced from the issue of sexism in the church. Hopkins notes, we must continue the vocation of racial equality with the vocation of gender equality. And finally, England believes the church must be transformative. He believes the LDS church must speak against evil, social evil, and challenge unequal racial conditions. Finally, as we continue this problem, or approach it contextually, stressing attentiveness, intentional rootedness, inclusivity, and transformation, I believe this may also, at some level, be a good framework, particularly for the spirituality of the rising generation, which is this year's theme. High school students, college students, young professionals in the LDS Church must not forget their past, but embrace it. But not be crippled by it either. Not romanticize it, but accept where things went wrong and are going wrong. And be willing to speak truth to power as they grow in faith and love. Thank you. Yeah.
Good job, Roy. Thank you. I'm going to challenge a few little things. You said 178 years after. What date are you suggesting that the priesthood restriction came into being? What year? Oh, come join me. We can do this together at the mic, because I'm going to be engaging him in dialogue. I'm not just going to respond. We'll have a conversation. And we'll allow you to participate in a little bit, if you can keep it succinct.
This is my friend here. Okay, this is what I did. Now, when you locate when the priesthood ban began, the scholars somewhat differ on the topic. And so what I did was, generally, I think most scholars like to use the 1852 as like the strong benchmark of when the formal proclamation by Brigham Young to exclude this particular group was started. And then it's pretty universally agreed when it had ended. Now, one source says that 3 years prior, however, there was a conversation between Brigham Young and Lorenzo Snow, and supposedly Young had articulated that blacks wouldn't partake then. So that's basically where I come up with the particular figure that I did.
Hey, hang around. There were even a few intimations in 1847 with William McCary and statements, will you follow a man who hath no right to the priesthood? But I personally go with the 1852 because that's when we have it set. But I'm wiggly on that one too, because in 1879, after Brigham Young's death, the issue comes up again, because Elijah Abel, who had been ordained, had been washed and anointed in the Kirtland Temple, petitions for his endowment. Again, he had already asked Brigham Young, and Brigham Young had turned it down. But with Brigham Young dead, the issue is raised again. And that's when we have the meeting of 1879, called by John Taylor. He invites Zebedee Coltrane, Abraham Smoot, who supposedly have some idea of what Joseph Smith said. They were not concerned so much with what Brigham Young had said. They knew that what that was. What had Joseph Smith said? And Coltrane claimed that Joseph Smith had said the blacks have no right to the priesthood. And then he went on, Coltrane, to say that as soon as Elijah Abel's race was discovered, he was dropped from the quorum. Elijah Abel's race was certainly known because he was asked at one point to preach only to his own kind. Zebedee Coltrane's memory was challenged not only verbally, but by documentation, by Joseph F. Smith, who showed two certificates showing that Abel's priesthood had been verified by certificate as a 70 in 1841 and after his arrival in Salt Lake, which was 1853. So I actually keep it pretty, you know, the setting of the priesthood restriction a little wiggly, because they're still asking in 1879 what really is our policy. And I really don't have a set date until 1908, just after the death of Jane Manning James, just prior to the death of Jane Manning James, when Joseph F. Smith kind of goes back on what he had said earlier and sounds a lot more like Zebedee Coltrane than he had. But let's go through the various methods. You quoted Bruce R. McConkie in 1958. He did amend the parts on preexistence and, of course, on priesthood in the 1979 edition. But the fact that the book on the shelves now is the 1979 edition and continues to state that physical differences are an indication of spiritual degeneration, and we can tell how far we've fallen, basically, by how much we look like Adam and Eve. Now, my own personal take on that is, you know, genetics lead us back to Africa. So I've wanted to I've wanted to do a little
I'm glad you said it. I didn't know if I could go there though.
I wanted to do it in our documentary as a special feature, but I don't think we could afford that kind of price-wise. But I wanted to take Black Adam and Eve and turn them Norwegian and indicate spiritual degeneration. They end up looking like me. The guilt by association, as you were talking about that, and Roy kindly sent me what he was going to say, so I knew what he was going to talk about, but the guilt by association, the sins of the fathers, and the idea of should we... I've heard many people say, I didn't hold slaves, I shouldn't have to apologize for that, I didn't do any of this, that was way back. And as somebody who lives much of her life in an English department, and my husband teaches the Brothers Karamazov at least once a year, and it's a life-changing book for me. Have you read it yet? On your list. Father Zosima makes a profound statement, and it's repeated throughout, where he says, all are responsible for all, and I more than any. Meaning, I don't know what little act I may have committed in my past that resulted in a concatenation of events that eventually caused the death of this child. We tend to want to say, no, I'm not responsible for that. That was my ancestor, but that ended with them. They died. Instead of moving towards responsibility, which is one of the great themes of the Brothers Karamazov, and saying, not only do I accept responsibility, but I will say I am more responsible. And that calling to responsibility for, and especially as we deal with race issues, what are we individually doing? And I like the issues that you're bringing up. Are we being transformative, not just in our thinking, but in our actions? As a mother of four and grandmother of three, this has been a huge issue in our family. I met Darius Gray 10 years ago, and our family life, which already included a whole lot of Spanish, because I taught Spanish Institute, and so we had Mexican friends over all the time, then expanded. In Provo, Utah, you really don't have a whole lot of opportunity for diverse associations. We were really lucky in our little home. I remember we were sitting with cast members of I Am Jane, and Marvin Perkins got a drink of water and came into the room and looked at me and said, oh my gosh, Margaret's white. We were all sitting here, and it just suddenly occurred to me, and I really didn't realize it, Margaret's white. And, you know, because it was a non-issue, of course. We were working together on a project. Now, what's finally happened is my daughter, my oldest daughter, within the last week, she and her husband have decided that they don't want to stay in Utah. And one of the big issues for her is diversity. She doesn't want her children raised in a place where there's not a diverse population. And my son-in-law just accepted a job in Indiana. So they'll be, maybe Eric's father will be their bishop. They're heading there in January. Do come stand by me. You mentioned Robert Millet. who I think says some really good things, but I also think we need to mention what happened recently. Kami's smiling. He knows exactly where I'm going with this. The rebroadcast of a religion series. It's a KBYU series presented by professors in the religion department commenting on various, you know, taking you through the scriptures. For a lot of people, it's their Sunday school class. People outside get satellite television, and there are these renowned religion professors who are giving instruction. And in episode 10 of The Pearl of Great Price, the subject was priesthood restriction through the ages. And we got wind, we, meaning the Bloggernacle, we got wind of the fact that this was going to be rebroadcast, and we were able to listen to a podcast. And we were appalled, because the sorts of things that were being said, first of all, Brother Millett turning to the colleagues and saying, now I'm very comfortable with the idea that the priesthood restriction came into being by revelation given to Joseph Smith, and I assume the rest of you are too. And there was a communal assent, you know, nod of assent, sort of audible, oh yeah, sure. And it was just sort of an astonishing, what? Are you really, truly saying that? And then they continued to talk about the hard doctrine, because it's so socially sensitive, but the very strong implication that it came from God. Now, many of us tried very hard to not have that rebroadcast happen. It did happen. I don't know if it, and that was only, that's been just within a few months that that was rebroadcast on KBYU. The fact that that was rebroadcast, and the fact that it indicates that that is still being taught. My children have come home telling me things that they've learned, and I will say, just an example of my son, my oldest son, in a priest quorum, they just opened it up for questions, and somebody asked about the priesthood restriction, and the Sunday school teacher, who was 25, and I give the age on purpose because sometimes we say it was generational. The older generation may have those ideas, but the younger generation has been cleansed of them because of 1978. And the teacher said, well, let me explain the curse of Cain. And my son raised his hand and said, that's not church doctrine. And the teacher said, well, all right, something happened in the pre-existence in the war in heaven where blacks were less valiant than others, and so they were born into this particular lineage. And my son raised his hand and said, that's not church doctrine. And the bishop was eventually... thank you, I'll tell my son. The bishop was eventually called in and said, we don't know. And that is the official church stand. If you, I don't think any general authority is going to say anything other than that. The silent approach. We do have President Hinckley. Okay, I hope I'm not wearing you out. Okay, in 2003, the very important statement that he made in the priesthood session of General Conference, where he said, how can any man holding the Melchizedek priesthood arrogantly assume that he is eligible for the priesthood, whereas another who lives a righteous life but whose skin is of a different color is ineligible, without bracketing it in since 1978. I'm just thinking of Mitt Romney. You knew the question was going to come up. So your church didn't give priesthood to blacks till 1978. And his response was, I remember when I heard that the ban was lifted. That tends to be our response. In fact, when we open to questions, unless I'm taking too much time, are we okay? That's something I'm going to caution you against doing. We tend to notice sometimes opening up to questions, people want to tell their experience in 1978. Most of us had a really good experience on that day. But that tends to be the way we deal with it. That, in my experience, what I've heard, when these very difficult questions are asked, and Mitt Romney gives the presidential candidate way to respond, I remember pulling off the side of the road, not to question his sincerity, I'm sure he was sincere, and weeping with joy because of the lifting of that ban. Now, the example that you gave of Hindus and caste systems, I'll just mention that Mormon Doctrine still contains a section, Mormon Doctrine being a book by Bruce R. McConkie, written not when he was an apostle, but seriously questioned when it was published, but then reprinted, and it continues to be on the shelves. But that does have a whole section called caste systems. So just tying it in. But I would compare, when you talk about throwing stones at glass houses, the sort of, you guys did it too. I would also remind all of us that other religious organizations that have recognized that there were racialist policies in their past have apologized. The Catholic Church has, the Baptist Church has. If you can look them up. We don't have, the closest thing we have that I am aware of, I would say, is President Hinckley's. And I don't say Bruce R. McConkie's, although Bruce R. McConkie made his statement in 1978 where he said, forget everything I have said. We were working with limited light and knowledge. We get our truth line upon line, precept on precept. There has now come a flood of light that erases all the darkness of the past. But then he went on to reprint Mormon Doctrine, and it still had the same stuff in it, with everything related to the blacks will never have the priesthood amended. Now, come join me. Now you're nervous. Come on. I'm sorry. What I want to do, since Roy is not LDS, and he's just given a lovely paper, so has earned the right to just speak, I just want to ask, as a non-Mormon African-American, what do you see, and I'm not actually talking in an academic sense, just you, Roy, not Dr. Whitaker. when you think of Mormons, and somebody says a black Mormon, what are the sorts of images that come to your mind? If you can divorce yourself from the academic.
Take off that hat, put on a new one. I see. So more of the personal, reflective ones. Well, I am also interested maybe in responding a little bit to your important point you made mention of as well. Let me just note really quickly before I maybe move to that last question you asked me. The first method I talked about, the guilt by association and the sins of the father approach, and basically blaming past prophets and using that as leverage against Mormons today. In the back of my mind, I had in mind particularly those who stand outside the church and who know very little about the internals of the LDS church. Unfortunately, as most of us know, the church is very much characterized. Those on the outside, like myself, can easily pick one or two doctrines, quote-unquote, and just run to the hills with those and not think about the internals of the tradition. Now, to understand Mormon thought, there is a strong sense of autonomy or self-agency, right? Okay. So I wanted to sort of appreciate that dynamic. For example, Mormons don't believe in original sin. That sort of cuts the vein off of you responsible for your own self, for your own problems. The romanticized approach is really my critique of LDS relative to embracing more of responsibility in order to move forward. Similarly, correct, Hinckley 2006, okay, if that is the closest thing to an official repudiation of racist theology, then maybe as an outsider, but even in my general research, I don't think it's sufficient in the least. And I say that for a number of reasons. Because that particular talk he gave at a general conference, mm-hmm. Okay? Now, the issue is this. It was titled,
Show Greater Kindness.
Yes, Show Greater Kindness. Yeah. Show Greater Kindness. My experience in the black community is that blacks don't want kindness, they want justice.
Good.
Good answer. Good answer. That's nice. I mean, you know, a smile and is nice, and you know what I mean? You can have, you know, breakfast together. But there's a strong sense of the desire to set things right. And this sort of gets basically to your own your question about just my personal interaction. I was doing some work and research on this, and Professor Moss is here, matter of fact. Basically, taking my thought from his, there's a number of layers to this. This is very complicated. But there's a fear amongst Orthodox Mormons, or the most extreme Mormons, in terms of conservative thought, that if there is a full admission to this originating within human beings, this band started with humans, it sort of seems to undermine the prophetic word at some level. Right? So therefore, what happens today, just to be objectively true, is you would have to always question the validity of what the prophet says to be consistent. Now, that's antagonistic with particularly McConkie's words in 1978, where he basically turns on a dime. I've never seen it like this sort of dynamic. He says, don't believe, forget about what I said. He says, forget about what I said. Follow the modern prophet. And there's a theme in Mormonism to follow the modern prophet, right? So on the one hand, Mormons want to respect, of course, the prophet. But at the same time, I feel, even as an outsider, it's not an either-or situation. I think there must be a stronger sense of a hermeneutic of suspicion, questioning all words given by the prophet, particularly if there's a track record of a policy that has been discriminatory. See, when the priesthood was revealed, there's words talk about jubilation. But what I want to read one time in the literature, I haven't read this yet, is for the church to acknowledge that it wasn't on June 8th, 1978, but the priesthood ban was wrong on June 7th, 1978. It was wrong on June 5th, June 4th, June 3rd, June 4th. It was all the time. Not just on this date. And then finally, just to answer this, I personally feel that there's a disconnect between the authority of the church and the everyday Joe Blow Mormon. Because in 2006, Hinckley says literally, it's come to my attention that there are race issues. Now, I don't know where the apostles live. I'm serious. I don't know where they live. My assumption is in Salt Lake somewhere. Maybe I can meet them afterwards. I would love to. But my point is, you know, I know the church is very, very hierarchical and authoritarian institution. So I'm just trying to find a way how the voices of those who have been excluded get heard in the larger church. Now, quickly, the Genesis group, I applaud it. I think they have done great things to move the church forward. However, to me, it's a structural problem, too. An auxiliary group is an auxiliary group. If you meet one the first Sunday every month at a certain time, basically, I think there needs to be more of a revolutionary or a turning upside down, whereby the curriculum and the seminary and everything from head to bottom, bottom to top, gets reoriented. Because the church, even as an outsider, has much to offer the world.
Oh, beautiful answers. I'm going to disagree with you a little bit on the Genesis group. I don't think the Genesis group is particularly powerful. Anybody want to, who might have been president of the Genesis group, want to respond to that? Do you disagree, Darius?
No.
I think the Genesis... go ahead. If you want to come to the mic, you need to be mic'd.
Roy is correct. The structure is such that it limits what the organization can do. And Margaret is correct. The Genesis group is not powerful in its official structure and organization. But I would contend that it is powerful and that it is helping to modify the playing field so that all of us are different within the church because of its existence. And therefore, it's a sub-level power, but it's not because of its position and structure within the church.
And we want to save a bit of time for questions and answers. Let me just take 30 seconds. I would say just visually, one of the big things we contend with, and what the church often tends to do, or church leaders, is say we're doing so well in Africa. But the issues are much different for African-Americans. That's something that I just tend to stiffen as soon as I hear us talking about Africa, not to take anything away from wonderful things that are happening there. But I think that the way the church looks, we are still so white. And maybe my favorite point of everything you said was the lack of diversity in the high-ranking positions. I long for the day when we are truly showing every complexion. Let's go ahead for questions.
I was just raising my hand in anticipation that you might be ending soon so that I could ask a question.
Please ask a question.
Let's start questions. I'm going to exercise my chair prerogative and ask the first question, and then we'll have Brian. And I just wanted to say, you know, and get both of your comments on this. I was 1.5 when the revelation came about in 1978, or when the policy was changed, and I wanted to ask on this topic of silence, because that seems to me the largest problem. Because I remember being a missionary, and I relate to this 25-year-old Sunday school teacher going and people saying, well, we don't know. Well, that's not good enough. This wasn't a small thing. And so when you combine silence with a culture where everything church leaders in the past have said is true, then you go and you find these statements and you look for them. And I found Bruce R. McConkie and Brigham Young and these other things. And that's where this is perpetuated, because people want to know. And it seems to me that that's what I'm holding out hope for, is some sort of statement that simply says, God was not the racist, Brigham Young was the racist. I don't know why we insist on making God the racist.
Well, and if it had just been Brigham Young, it wouldn't have continued.
Right.
Yeah, I think regarding that particular issue, it is somewhat puzzling to me, because in 2006, when Hinckley made his statements, who is well-respected, and I've heard a little bit about him even before studying Mormonism, he says in that conference meeting that he is basically surprised that individuals may be still racist in the church. But there's a sense in which I really think, and I mean this genuinely though, that church leaders in 1978, I think in their minds, based upon what I've read, they really thought it was over. I mean, sincerely, there's no conspiracy theory. They really thought that was the case, but that is, I think, a tension there.
And let me just be sure, what you're saying is that we really need a strong repudiation, and probably not just once, but something that is repeated over and over. Darius and I have in our files letters that we've gotten of people correcting us and suggesting that we haven't become familiar with doctrine that blacks were not violent in the period of existence, and also that Jews are being persecuted because they killed Christ. That's one of the letters in our files.
In 2005, I went on a humanitarian expedition to Africa with a group of Presbyterians, Mormons, and Black Baptists. And one of the Baptists came to me one night and he said, "How can you belong to a racist church? I don't get it." Kind of really in your face. And it really kind of caught me by surprise. And I had kind of a weak response, and I found myself getting defensive. And in retrospect, I'm very unhappy with my response, because, you know, thinking through it in a rational way, I knew that to be true. For some reason, I had a hard time admitting it to him, and I don't know why. Maybe because I'm racist.
You wouldn't have been there if you were racist.
And so, anyway, and my 17-year-old son was extremely offended by the whole exchange. And so, you know, there goes the hope for the young generation. But anyway, When I got back, a few months later, I got back, and in our ward, the scouts do a fundraiser where they put flags out on all the holidays. And so the stake made a decision that because of weather, they were not going to put flags out on Martin Luther King Day or President's Day. So I went to the bishop, and I told him I thought this was wrong. And I told him that I thought at the very least, from a public relations point of view, it was a big mistake. He basically had no interest in discussing it in any way at all. And to this day in our state, we don't put flags out on Martin Luther King Day or President's Day. So I'm kind of discouraged, both with myself and with the institution.
The question of representation in the leadership, has there been any math done on how many we should have there? I mean, think about what it takes. I mean, I'm not qualified to be there, and I'm white. So what it takes to have a qualified person there, and I don't know who qualifies them, but there could be some guesswork done, how long they've been in the church, whatever. What's the demographic, and how many should we see in leadership in the church? We don't, because, I mean, how many black members are there, period?
About a million, if I'm correct. About a million black members, which includes Africa, the Caribbean.
So doing the numbers, and I'm thinking of all of the ethnic groups we're looking at. Has there been any math done?
Go.
Well, I believe our resident scholar and leader of the Genesis group can tell us more of the demographics than I think you can as well. My point regarding the issue of diversity of church leadership, it's not so much of the pragmatic or number sense or, you know, who's really qualified for it. We all know that the numbers of blacks are less than the other numbers in the church. But I'm just basically trying to understand, this is part of the outsider-insider perspective I'm trying to offer. It's one thing I've challenged my other Mormon friends about. In effect, and you can speak to this even better, but the question is, what resources are there in the Mormon church for non-whites? Resources, cultural resources, for example.
Could you get more specific?
More specific, for example, is that basically the Christian worldview has really posited a, you know, blonde hair, blue eyes, Caucasian Jesus. What black theology would do, for example, even contextual theology, would seek to sort of reinterpret some of these symbols and signs in light of the culture that it comes from. And you were sort of hinting to it too, basically thinking of Adam and Eve not as coming from Jackson, Missouri or here, but maybe looking at it more sociologically and historically coming from Africa. So my point regarding the diversity of leadership is basically to indicate sharply what are the faces leading the church. And ultimately, if we're really frank about it, you have a 12 apostles, you have a quorum, faces are individuals who are defining the race issue. They have the power. And we can make a big muck about it all we want, but they still have the power to define the issue. So I just want to basically throw that in the mix.
Good.
But there's other questions, comments.
Thank you, Roy. I enjoyed your paper and wanted to. I've been an admirer from a distance. Roy, you said something really important and interesting. You said that the attitudes of the people contributed to the revelation. And as many people here know, one of the common responses to the question as to why it took so long was that the revelation would not fall on fertile soil. Now, as someone who filters things in terms of theological implications, that's radical. And I don't think that the church has reflected upon how radical that idea is, namely, that revelation can be grassroots. The implication of that idea is that there can be push toward the leadership regarding certain cultural and social phenomena, which implies that there can be a certain kind of activism at the grassroots level that might move the church ahead in that regard. Of course, it's a dynamic relationship, dialectic relationship, because the membership looks to the leadership for their cues in terms of issues of social justice. And so long as Mormon doctrine, right, and other kinds of implicit ideologies are in place, there's not going to be social transformation. So I'd like your comment on that.
You take it, and then I'll take it.
Okay, well, I don't have very much to add, but I think the interplay you bring up is very fair. I attempted to highlight very briefly the interplay at some level. of how those blacks inside and even blacks outside helped to create a context where a theological position or a practice could change. And the long and short of it is, I think, and I've articulated and actually good work done on what we would call a type of Mormon theology of liberation, right? Just to like theorize it. But yeah, I think the grassroots is necessary.
You know, Brian, when you were talking about the dialogue and the dialectic, it looked like it was equal, but it's not.
Right.
And that's one of the big issues.
We but don't.
In your dreams, we would hope. But the truth is, if you were to write a letter expressing your concern about the continuation of racist teachings, you would probably say thank you for your letter, and you would receive the same letter that other people who have expressed that have received, saying that it's certainly something the brethren are concerned about, and will sign the secretary.
Right. My point, very quickly, my point just went to the idea that the implications of the idea that it wouldn't have fallen on fertile soil are radical, in that if there had been a different attitude on the part of the church before, then the revelation could, in principle, have come before.
And we probably should mention that, you know, we had the we had Hugh B. Brown, we had Ezra Taft Benson, and a whole David O. McKay was not a proponent of civil rights, and nonetheless he wept several times when Marion D. Hanks approached him about this issue. It was deeply troubling to him, and he felt that he didn't get a reply to his prayers.
Yeah, I'm going to preface my question with a short passage from a book, it's actually an apologetic work written by a BYU professor in 1967, which I think is still reflective of the views that many Mormons have today from the book The Church and the Negro. Just real quickly, he says, Brigham Young revealed that the Negroes will not receive the priesthood until a great while after the advent of Jesus Christ, whose coming will usher in a millennium of peace. In view of what President Young and others have said, it would be foolish indeed to give anyone the false idea that a new revelation is immediately forthcoming on the issue of the Negroes receiving the priesthood. You know, 11 years later, it did come. So if the prophet of God were to receive a revelation tomorrow giving the Negroes a priesthood, it would be certainly big steps regardless of what Brigham Young or any other previous prophet has said. This is because the words of the living oracles relate more specifically to the era in which we live. Mormons view a prophet as God's literal mouthpiece on earth. The faithful Latter-day Saints accept the prophet's words as God's will. Prophets do not inspire God. God inspires prophets.
Is that John Lund?
That is John Lund. Right.
Well, I'll just... Go ahead.
It comes from this. And the question is, you know, a lot of times we talk about, well, repudiation of the ban itself needs to come forth because... And the big problem is if you don't repudiate the ban, if the ban's in place, then, you know, most Latter-day Saints will say, well, it came from Brigham Young. You know, other, not just Brigham Young, but other prophets, you know, continued it and said this was revealed. And the view is, well, if it is revealed, then there's got to be a reason behind it. And that's why even if you get rid of, you say, look, you know, the Cain thing is wrong, the 3-6 thing is wrong, there's always going to be a vacuum left open to fill with some kind of racist speculation. So my question is what kind of steps do you feel must be taken before, because it seems like if the church came out today, a lot of Latter-day Saints have a problem because they say, wait a minute, how can a prophet be wrong? Now my whole world's falling apart. So what steps do you believe must be taken before, or do steps need to be taken before repudiation can be made?
Before I respond to that, and I want Roy to respond as well, and my honest answer is, I have no control over, you know, I know what I would like to see happen, but I can't make it happen. But I wanted to say about John Lund, we interviewed him for the documentary. We did not use any of the footage. We wanted to see how he might have changed since having written that book. And it was very interesting. I'll just tell you two things that he said that aren't either in the doc or in the special features. He said, follow the modern prophet. That's and precisely what it was. So he made no repudiation of anything he had said. And then he was asked, so if a Mormon had racist views, should they not have a temple recommend? And John Lund said, that is correct. They should not have a temple recommend. So that's John Lund in 2005, I think is when we interviewed him. I think the repudiation is the biggie often, and you know, expect it. Just like we hear about pornography at every general conference, hit it.
Just at least a major response to what you're saying. Unfortunately, and maybe my comments might have led to this, or maybe even our discourse here, I think there's a false assumption that an official policy rebuking the priesthood ban historically, that many of us, I think, are waiting for, is the silver bullet. And I don't think that that is accurate. I think that there will be, or needs to be, a number of things take place. And I told this to a friend the other day who is in the church. In effect, as an outsider, what I see is I see the Mormon church making problems for itself when it really doesn't need to be there. See, there's a fear, and I understand it. See, there is, I would call it an internal Mormon dialogue, and then there is the public dialogue. Because the church is outside the mainstream of traditional Christianity. In addition to that, the church is restored, right? True gospel, so forth. And so therefore, the assumption is you guys have it right. But by admitting having this policy in place sort of undercuts your uniqueness argument at some level. So there's always this tension that's going to be the case. So my response is multiple things need to be done. Anything to the DNC regarding those passages which make black skin bad, Lamanites, and so forth. So I think a combination of things need to be done.
We're out of time. You guys can ask your questions, but keep in mind people might be coming in, and we might miss this last part on the recording. But if you want to ask your questions, but please be patient if others come in or leave, because we are over the time.
I'm an LDS woman, so I'm very familiar with what it's like to have a parade of male faces teaching me the gospel. And I am very aware of when something is said from General Conference to Relief Society that hurts women, disempowers women. I'm very aware when they say something that's helpful to women and empowers women. However, although I've lived in many different places, I've lived largely in a white context. And so I don't always hone in on what people say or what I may say that is hurtful to my black brothers and sisters, saints in the church, or helpful. So I would love some just very practical thoughts on what I may say that could be hurtful that I should avoid, and what I may say that could be helpful, just on a very board level.
You know, I think you actually said it already, my black brothers and sisters. If that's the paradigm, that they are your brothers and sisters, then the risk is that suddenly, because you're so aware that you don't want to be racist, black becomes an exotic creature that you sort of make sure everything is taken care of and that there's no offense. But brothers and sisters is our paradigm.
I'll just say really quickly, I think, unfortunately, because of the context in which we use certain terms, it's sometimes taken out of context too quickly. But the fact remains that there were black Mormons consistently throughout the church history when the ban was in place. And based on my own experience, blacks have been so faithful to the church in the midst of the ban, right? And when one enters into serious dialogue or earnest dialogue, it's tough to go wrong when you want to have an open conversation about various issues and topics. So I think your consciousness is, I think, sufficient for many.
Most of the denominations did poorly in the 19th century. The Methodists and the Baptists held out better than some before they split in the northern and southern branches. Quakers did very well. One of the things, there's two systems, Catholicism and Mormonism, which have a view of authority which really makes it difficult for them to do what Christians traditionally call repent. Repentance isn't merely having a hermeneutic of suspicion towards all human power. It's being able to get down on our knees and say before God, we were wrong. Now, for example, even the Southern Baptists repented in the 90s of their participation in slavery and their whole reasons for dividing. So really, ultimately, I see this as a truth claim functioning issue. Until you redefine, I don't have a hermeneutic of suspicion in the sense that I say there is no divine voice, no divine authority on earth. But when the divine authority keeps getting it wrong and having to create ways of doing sophistry to redefine and sidestep, then the question is, either we need to redefine or we need to get out. And like, for example, my own background is Roman Catholic. And the infallibility decision was a destructive one because it put into place this place where you had to say, well, you know, he thought he was speaking from the chair when he made that dogma, but we're not sure, you know. And so, because if he was, then he was infallible. So the question is, so I doubt the LDS Church will ever say, yes, we're going to encourage a hermeneutic of suspicion towards our prophets so that we'll get rid of it this way. I think what's needed is more a redefinition of the prophetic role, and it's right there where the prophets of the Old Testament are individually called, they come from out of the wilderness, they don't have an official office with the government, or when they do, they're often lackeys of the king. So anyway, can you talk to that?
I just think those are interesting thoughts, do you?
Interesting thoughts, and I would just say the hermeneutic of suspicion is part and parcel of re-examining and redefining the role of the prophet in issues of infallibility. But I think our time is up.
Yeah.
Thank you.